With Dr. Catherine Ramsland, we're talking about her work, Confession of a Serial Killer. This is the story of Dennis Rader, the BTK Killer, a most remarkable book, and what a story. But we're going to come back and take your calls with her next on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Catherine Ramsland with us. Catherine, did he have a weapon when he went to seduce and bond these people?
Yes, he did. He used a gun in the first place to threaten them, but his real intent was to
bond
them into bondage. But he always had a knife and at least two guns with him.
Yeah, that's what did. And if people knew that he was a serial killer and that they were going to face that death, they would have fought their way at least, and he'd have to shoot them. But nobody knows that in the beginning, do they?
Well, right, they don't know, but there was one where he did tell her, but only after he had bound her. I think it was a little bit of psychological torture that he wanted to throw in.
So he's in jail now. As you mentioned, he's 70, 71 years old. What's he do besides playing chess with people?
He plays chess. He writes a lot of letters to people. He watches TV. He reads the newspapers. He follows the farm reports.
Would he be interviewed on this radio show if we worked it out?
He's not allowed to use the facility phones to call out for interviews.
He is not.
Yeah.
But you can you go and interview him there?
You can't bring cameras in. You'd have to get on his approved list of visitors, and then you can go if he... If he wants you to, then you can get on his list.
His wife that he was married to for 39 years, who divorced him after all this, she's got to be in shock.
She was completely in shock. She never went into the house again.
You'll never be the same after that.
No, because you think you know someone. You have entrusted most of your life to them. You've had children with them, and they've done these unbelievable, unthinkable things.
Are most of these serial killers loners? They're not married?
A lot of them are, but we certainly have a lot who are married and who have families as well. He's not that unique in that regard.
Jeez, just a bizarre story. I remember when I first heard about it. It was just so weird, especially when they talked about his church association and all this other stuff. Was that just a front?
No, it wasn't a front. I mean, he really had these compartments in his life. That was a compartment he took seriously. He didn't take the religious stuff that seriously, but he took his family seriously. He took his job seriously. He lived in compartments.
In Kansas, obviously, they don't have a death penalty, do they?
Well, they did, but he had. Then they got rid of it, and he was. His murders were within the time when they didn't have it.
Why did he plead guilty and not try to cop a plea?
You know, let me read. They actually have it now. They didn't have it during his murder.
Right, that's what I meant.
But they have it now, yeah.
Okay. And why did he plead guilty? Why didn't he just try to go for insanity?
Well, I don't think he could have made insanity stick at all. But I think it was talking to his daughter. And not talking to her, she wrote letters to him and asked him to please not put the families through this. And so in the end, he just decided there was no, they had him. They had DNA. They had him. And there wasn't any real reason to have a trial.
Bizarre.
I mean, the way it would have served his ego, of course. It would have been a big splashy thing all over the world. But he did, in the end, consider his family's feelings.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take some calls. We're going to go to Josh, first-time caller in Pittsburgh, Kansas. This ought to be interesting. Hey, Josh, did you know him? What do we have?
I didn't know him, but I was really good friends with his family. I'm from the hometown of where he was born in Pittsburgh, Kansas.
Uh-huh, okay.
And basically, they said, like, on, like, the family reunions, he'd come down and get together, and he was just really quiet, really smart, but really quiet. Kind of hung to himself a lot. I mean, he'd go and talk to everybody when they wanted to talk, but for the most part, though, he just kind of stood to himself. I guess he got, when he was younger in town, he'd get in trouble in there, and his parents would cover up for him a lot for things that he would do, like mischievous things. But they said he was just, when they found out, they said that they wasn't surprised. It was just kind of like,
really?
Sense.
Huh. What do you think, Catherine?
My understanding is that they were surprised and horrified and thought the police had made a mistake.
Initially.
Yes.
You had mentioned that some people didn't like him. Did he have a temper?
He was a very rigid personality. He kind of demanding and short with people. It wasn't so much a temper as just not very friendly.
Would he work with someone and ever threaten to kill them or anything like that? Did anybody ever
Not
report that?
there was never anything like that, but there were people who, after the fact, thought that they might have become his victim, that perhaps they were in danger because he would watch them, or he didn't treat them well. There were people who, in fact, one of his coworkers wrote a book about it.
Did he ever try to kill someone because he just didn't like the person?
No.
Okay. So that would not do anything
He
for him.
wasn't motivated by that. He was motivated by his sexual
The
fantasies.
fantasies and the
Yeah.
bondage and things like that. Let's go
Now
next.
he did. Now he did say if somebody had, like, if in one case a man came in with a woman he was waiting for, so she had a date. She comes in with a date. He would have killed that man if the man had stayed overnight. He would have killed him
He
for that.
would have.
Yes.
Just because it was there. Wrong place,
Just
wrong
because he was
time.
there. Exactly.
Aaron in New Orleans, welcome to the program. Hi, Aaron. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, from what I understand on this case, the BTK killer, he worked as a code enforcement for the local county, and it seems like a perfect cover, if you're going to be on somebody's front lawn or somebody's property to say, well, you're checking something for the code enforcement. But what my question was, either this or any other serial killer that you may have researched, have you found that they tend to use some kind of a ruse, like, for example, like having like a fake cast or saying that they're looking for a lost pet or that their car
Well,
broke down?
Bundy had the fake cast on his
Yeah.
arm.
Yeah.
Right. And my second question,
I wouldn't
my
say they tend to. I would say we certainly have the more predatory and organized ones will figure out a way to bait their victims or follow them. And Bundy is famous for the ruse he used, and Zodiac used a ruse, and Raider used a ruse. But I don't know that that's necessarily a tendency.
Okay, and my second question was that, have you done any research into the smiley face killer?
Yes.
And did
There's
you find
actually a
that
whole
too?
book written about them, and it's very interesting book. It's an academic book about all the autopsy reports and the investigations. While most of the police jurisdictions completely dismiss that they are linked, these two authors actually do a pretty good job showing that, we really have to look at these again. But for the most part, the police tend to think the smiley face killer is a myth.
The Anthony Hopkins portrayal of Hannibal Lecter, is that based on a true story?
It's based on five true
Oh,
stories.
they mixed them all in, huh?
Yeah, the problem with Hannibal Lecter is he's too much of a mix. So some of the psychotic features don't actually go along with the sophisticatedness and the accomplishments of this character. When I do a lecture on him, I talk about the fact that when you put all these personality features together, they just don't work.
Isn't Ed Gein part of that?
He was
Because
the Buffalo Bill character.
that's right, with the
Yeah.
skin dancing
Right.
around and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Mike in Cleveland, it's your turn. Michael, go ahead.
Hey, good morning, George.
Hi,
Good
Mike.
morning, Doctor.
Hello.
Hello. I just wondered if you ever looked into the Anthony Sowell case and the fact that maybe did it surprise anyone in your field that he was a younger black man that killed 11 women and buried him in the house?
It
And
doesn't
I was wondering
surprise.
if you
Yeah,
looked
I
into
know the
that.
Anthony Sowell case in the Ohio. It doesn't surprise anyone who researches serial killers because there are a lot of black serial killers. They just aren't as mediagenic as the white ones, so they don't get covered to the same depth and as white male serial killers. So no surprise to me at all that he would be like that. The big surprise is keeping the body parts in the house. We don't have. There are serial killers who do that. We don't have a lot of them, though.
One was Wayne Williams down in Atlanta. He was a serial killer, I think,
Right.
right?
Yeah. There's a lot of them. I mean, really, actually, there are.
John Wayne Gacy, Gary Ridgway, Ted Bundy,
yeah,
Dahmer. They all had their motives too, didn't they?
They
or
all
their
had their
MO.
motives, and they were different.
Did any of the parents ever sense anything was wrong with their kid? Or did they create him, literally?
Jeffrey Dahmer's father wrote a book called A Father's Story to talk about the many times he was in denial. He actually was holding a box with a head of one of Dahmer's victims, and he allowed Dahmer to persuade him not to open it. There are a number of things that Dahmer was able to deflect, and it's no surprise, because who wants to think their child is this horrible
monster
kind of being? So many people will not see even flagrant signals as being malignant. They will try to frame them in benign ways as much as possible.
Did Dennis Rader have a friend, a buddy, a guy?
Growing up, you mean?
Well, or even in his later life, a chum, somebody he went out with and got a beer with or something.
He didn't really chum around with people. He got along well with the pastor of his church because he was part of the whole kind of administration of that. But he wasn't close to anyone. He just stuck with his family pretty much.
Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you?
Good.
I'd like to ask Catherine, have you done any research into the Gigolo Beach, Long Island serial killer, or Joel Rifkin? And also, on Dennis Rader, did he keep any souvenirs or trophies of his victims?
Yes, and yes. I certainly pay attention because I'm in Pennsylvania. I'm very aware of. And I actually knew the psychologist who did the analysis of Rifkin, and I've seen some of the things that Rifkin has said publicly. The Long Island serial killer, Lisk, is the one I think you're talking about, who has not been identified, and it isn't clear which of the cases are linked and which aren't. I'd certainly keep an eye on that. Dennis Rader did take jewelry, and he took underwear from a lot of houses. He took jewelry from victims. He had what he called hidey holes, and he had a lot of them, where he would store all of his stash.
Any more questions there, Joseph?
I'm sorry?
You all set, or one more?
I wanted to know if she feels that Charles Manson is still relevant within this maybe class of serial killers.
Well, he's not a serial killer. He was convicted of being a mastermind of the spree.
Right, the provocateur.
Yeah, so although he probably is a serial killer, there isn't. We don't have evidence against him, and he was never convicted of that. But he still continues to be categorized among the serial killers because he's so notorious and was so savage in the kinds of things he got his followers to do. Is he still relevant? I mean, they just had a whole show, Aquarius, devoted to the whole Manson family stuff. We constantly have documentaries about him. He has never been of that much interest to me, particularly, but certainly his name comes up a lot, and there's a lot of mystique about him still.
Catherine, these 15 to 20 serial killers who are roaming the country as we speak, do we know, I mean, are there any statistics from the FBI? Do we know what might be the longest streak of serial killer out there to date right now, of these 15 to 20 that you think are active?
Well,
how far
yet.
Back do they go?
Well, I wrote a book called The Human Predator where I trace serial killers back to ancient Rome. I mean, we have had serial killers in every culture, but it's not possible to say about the 15 to 20 because they're not known.
Can police say we know that one of them out there is responsible for 22 murders that have gone back for 30 years? Do they have that kind of data?
No, but the FBI has what's called the Serial Killer Highway Initiative, where they are looking at routes of truck drivers and looking at victims along those routes and trying to make links among them to see just how long, you know, who's driving those routes. Might these people be linked to those truck drivers. So they've been working on that quite a bit. But there's the only way you can say we definitely know somebody who's been killing, like the Long Island serial killer. That's a good example. We have a lot of cases in that area of Gilgo Beach, Long Island, that date back, but we don't definitely know that they're linked.
So you're saying, though, that there could be some serial killer truck drivers out there?
Certainly. We definitely know
that. By the way, we have the highest listenership of truck drivers than any show.
There aren't any serial killers.
He's out there listening right now. You might get a letter from one of them, or I will.
I don't think they'd be surprised. Keith Jesperson was a serial killer truck driver. He was known as the happy face serial killer, as opposed to the smiley face serial killer. He was a truck driver who claimed 7 or 8 victims and says there are many more than just that.
What determines a serial killer in terms of number?
Well, it used to be 3 in 3 separate incidents with a psychological cooling off period, but the FBI has changed it. They changed it in 2005 to 2 murders, 2 separate incidents. That is the official FBI definition.
You kill 2 people, 2 separate incidents, you're a serial killer.
That's right.
I don't think that's fair.
Oh, really?
I mean, to me, a serial killer has a method, goes after similar people, and there's...
Yeah, but it gets very complex when you start to categorize like that, because, for example, Gary...
A drug dealer who kills 2 people, does that make him a serial killer?
If he has a propensity to keep going, yes.
Well, maybe he's doing it because he needs money for drugs.
That's not a serial killer. They're not all motivated by sex. They're motivated by greed, profit, anger, mission, all kinds of things.
All right. Go ahead. You were going to say something else.
Yeah, and I mean, I wrote a book called Inside the Minds of Serial Killers where I look at a number of different methods because our common perception of them is that they're sexually motivated, but they're not. There are quite a few that are motivated for other purposes. And yes, but... I was going to talk about his name just slipped my mind. Gary Gilmore, who got out of prison, spent most of his life in prison, got out of prison. He murdered a guy on Monday, murdered a guy on Tuesday. They picked him up on Wednesday before he could kill anyone else. So he murdered 2 people, and yet he said, "Yes, I would have killed more if you hadn't arrested me." So that's the kind of person that criminologists say that would be a serial killer, because he thinks like a serial killer. He's going to continue to do it.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing it to rob people. Now, it wasn't sexually motivated, but he needed money. But then, on the other hand, you will find people who kill only 2 people, and that's all they're ever going to kill, because those 2 people were the only targets they ever had. So how do they fit in the serial killer category? That is a problem for the FBI's new definition. And they probably should put more parameters on it, such as the ones you mentioned. These are people who are stalking and planning and doing something, but it becomes very difficult to know how to create a definition that is really going to be inclusive and exclusive in all the right ways.
Never watched the show Dexter? The serial killer? We'll come back and talk about that, too, and take your final calls on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, by the way, special congratulations to a dear friend, Barbie Kligman. She's the creator and executive producer of ABC's show called Secrets and Lies. She created it. It's going to air again this Sunday night on the ABC stations, and it's a great program. You will love the plot, but Barbie has done a great job with that. And congrats again, Barbie. It's always good to see good people succeed, and that's going to be exciting. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. So did you ever watch, Catherine, the show Dexter, the good serial killer?
I watched it for the first season. He definitely wasn't a psychopath, because he worried too much about other people's feelings, and he just didn't have that callousness that you would expect.
No, he actually wanted to do good by getting rid of evil.
Yeah, I think that was more self-protection.
Yeah.
That was my sense, that his father had helped him figure out how to survive by forming this code. But no psychopath would ever really care one way or the other.
He was more of a vigilante, wasn't he?
Yeah, it seemed like it to me.
When you were doing the kind of work that you were doing, how do you shelter yourself from getting bombarded with all these depressive things?
Well, I think because I'm taking a clinical approach, I'm studying it every single day. I'm comparing case to case, and it doesn't affect me that much.
Kind of like rolls right off you?
I wouldn't say it rolls off me. I'm certainly creeped out sometimes, but I think because I'm studying it for a certain purpose, it's not the same as just indulging in gore fest, something like that.
What would you like people to come away with when they read Confession of a Serial Killer? What do you want them to learn?
Well, one of the things for my colleagues in criminology is to see that there's some of the formulas that we tend to have about serial killers that are not necessarily met in someone like Dennis Rader, and we need to rethink some of this and to include the outliers, you know, who don't really quite fit some of the conceptions we had. Like some of them would say to me, well, you know, he had to have been abused. You're going to have to find that in his background. Like, that's, you're bringing to the table a preconceived notion. We need to stop doing that if we're going to really learn. So that's one of the things. Another is simply being able to see that the blind spots in someone like him, that, you know, he says certain things, but then his behavior completely contradicts that. He says, well, I don't really want to go through this, but I'll do this for the victim's families. But then he delights in you know, drawing his torture devices and whatnot, and he'll spend hours doing that. So his behavior tells me there's something else going on. He tells me one story, but clearly something else is happening. So sort of experiencing that compartmentalization, that, you know, and people, if they can understand that this is a possible thing that people can do. They can compartmentalize, they can dissociate, they can live separate lives and seem to be normal but actually have this other side to them, that maybe they'll be a little more vigilant and not just accept everything they see. And then also there are lessons for law enforcement in this, because there were times when law enforcement might have stopped him or at least caught him earlier, but he was able to play to their ideas about good, decent people certainly are not serial killers. So.
A good point. Let's go to New York City. Keith's with us, Wildcard Line. Hey, Keith, go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi.
I'm a first-time caller, so let me just say that you are such an amazing radio guy.
Oh, thanks.
I got to hand it to you. Doc, I read, you referenced the Robert Beatty book earlier, which I read. I have more questions to ask than I could possibly get in. Here's a couple. I mean, some of the information in that book is different than what you said, so I'm a little bit confused in some of that. I still haven't figured out how he got past the Otero's dog, and I'm curious if he planned on leaving something behind had he not been caught. He's not proud of it. Would he have made a point to leave something behind, say, see, with me, you know, if he knew he was dying?
Yes. First, let me talk about the dog. He was surprised by the dog. He thought he had been so careful to really stake out the house and know what was going on, but he did not know that there was a dog. And he just simply told them, he had a gun, you either contain this dog or I will shoot it. So they made sure the dog was put outside. And that was basically how it happened. When he went through the back door, the young boy was about to put the dog out, but Rader pushed his way in. They restrained the dog. The dog was making a lot of noise. He said, put it outside. So that's essentially how he did that. In terms of leaving something behind, he wanted to achieve sort of a Jack the Ripper thing where he got away with it, but people would know that he, Dennis Rader, got away with it. So he was compiling items in a bank deposit drawer would then, after his death, would be able to find and then realize he's the guy that got away with it.
Oh, man. Any follow-up there, Keith? Go ahead, Keith. You have any follow-up for her?
Hey, no, I was just thinking that, you know, considering the fact that he won notoriety so bad, it didn't seem like the way he spoke in court and what you're describing, the way he's been since he's been in prison, you know, in correspondence with you and with others, he doesn't seem terribly upset. I mean, it's, you know, most people would be upset to be arrested. It seems like he doesn't really mind this part of his life. He's not that upset that he was arrested. He's not that upset that he's behind bars.
No, that's, he was upset when he was arrested when it first happened, and he realized his life had dramatically changed. He was never going home. He's never possibly not seeing his family again, and he had made a pretty serious error, so that really took him down in terms of his ego. So, yeah, there were things that upset him.
A cop picked him up, right, and said, "You do know why you're going downtown, Mr. Rader?" And he said, "I have my suspicions. Why?"
It was a swarm of officers, like dozens of officers picked him up. It wasn't just one. But he got into the car with Landwehr, who he knew from all the news conferences, and it was Landwehr who said that to him. But there were quite a few who stopped him and put him on the ground and handcuffed him. They really just swarmed in around him. But once he realized I'm caught, he gave in. I've read the transcripts of his confession to the police, right directly after his arrest. He accommodated it because he already had figured out what would happen if that did happen, if he was caught. And he just adapts. I mean, he's chameleonic. They all are. They just know how to survive in whatever situation they're in. I wouldn't say that he's overly smart, particularly. He would tell you he was a C and D student in school, but he was savvy in a lot of ways. And once he was caught, there was really no use in doing anything about it. He figured out ways to make it work for him.
Well, they sure did. Now, of the seven places that he killed the 10 people, how many was he the security alarm person for? Do you know?
I don't think any of them.
Oh, okay. I thought that's what he did.
He would check out. I mean, he knew
he cased places, but he didn't kill anybody.
Because he installed alarms. If he was at a place, he could tell what kind of alarm system they had.
All right.
And he also had records on people so that he could tell who was alone in the house and et cetera. But mostly he liked casing houses because he thought of himself as a spy. So he enjoyed that activity.
I would guess what some of the first things law enforcement might do when they investigate is, okay, what are the similarities between all these people? Who do they know? I mean, do they have the same garbage service? The
they
same.
They tried doing that.
Yeah, they do all that,
profilers
right?
Profilers in that they tried doing, but there weren't connections among these people.
No, that's why he was able to exist for what, 30 years doing this?
Yes. Yep.
Dave in Chicago, welcome to the program. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Morning, George and the good doctor. I got a little story for you, and you guys are going to tell me who the psychopath is. Want to try that one?
Okay, a little quiz, huh?
Well, I'm going to tell you what happened to me, and you're going to tell me who the guy was. But I'm not going to tell you his name.
Okay. She would know it better than I, but go ahead.
You might know this one, George. I've been wanting to tell you this story for a while.
Okay.
When I was a little kid, probably in the late 60s, I was probably about 10-ish. Can't remember exactly, but it felt like that. And you know how you sleep out in the tent and with your friends in the backyard and all that stuff when
yeah.
you're a kid? So we're in the backyard in the tent, and we decide we're going to sneak out and go play in the park and go around the town. It's at night. Meantime, we don't know this is going on. And my mom's in the house, and on the radio comes the story about breaking news about the killer that killed 8 student nurses on the south side of Chicago.
Richard Speck.
Yeah.
Richard Speck. Okay, well, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Well, anyway, we're out on the town, and my mom's freaking out because the guy's on the loose in our neighborhood after the killings. Remember, he escaped?
Yeah, but he wasn't on the loose for very long.
Well, he was out, real close to that, and on the news it was that he was out. So my mom's coming out to the tent to check on us, her kids, and we're not there. So we're out, and we get back in the tent, and we got our radio on, and we hear the story, and we're freaking out. Oh, my God, this guy's right in our neighborhood. And this guy is on the radio with the deep voice talking, and my mom comes out for like the third time. She's got her hoodie on and the butcher knife, And when she comes to the tent thinking these guys are in the tent with her kids because she hears this voice on the radio. And we look up and we see this shadow with the butcher knife coming down and we're just screaming. And then we found out we didn't even know what it was until that moment that we heard it and she was right there. It was the craziest thing.
Yeah, that's pretty scary.
That ever happened. I'll never forget that. But you guys remember the Richard Speck, was he a psychopath?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But not a serial killer, because he did all this at one time.
Mass murderer. Yeah.
That's right. Hey, David, thank you. Appreciate it. Next up.
He might have been a serial killer. He was suspected in a number of other ones.
Ah, okay. There's a person in Arizona shooting at cars.
Yeah.
They call him the serial shooter.
Yeah.
He's not trying to kill people, but he's doing something, isn't he?
Well, we don't know what he's trying to do. Maybe he's just a bad shot. We don't know what he's trying to do. Is he trying to annoy people? Is he trying to get attention to himself? You know, until we get him, we really won't know what his motive is.
All right, let's go to Joe in Long Island. It's your turn, east of the Rockies. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Yeah, Catherine. My question is, if you look at someone like Ken, the mafia with the hits, or Henry VIII killing his wives, they're not actually doing the killing. So would you consider them serial killers, and would they fit the profile of serial killers psychologically, maybe?
Well, there's no profile of a serial killer, but some hitmen have also been serial killers, like Richard Kuklinski is a good example, or Roy DeMeo.
Kuklinski, the Iceman, right?
Yeah, the Iceman. So some have certainly that psychological makeup, and they just happen to coincide with getting a job as a hitman, so it worked out for them. But not everyone. We generally don't consider someone who at war, for example, or a hitman who's hired. We don't consider them to be in that category of serial killers that we're talking about when we say that in criminology, or Henry VIII or something like that, because that's just like we don't say that someone who, you know, capital punishment, that the people who carry that out are serial killers. So it's a particular type of crime, and that's, you know, in war, that's not a crime. If a king does it, it's, you know, it's not a crime.
Long live the king, right?
Right.
When you went to school to study what, criminal justice or psychology?
No, actually, I went to school to study philosophy.
Really?
Yeah, my PhD is in philosophy.
How did you end up in the law enforcement end?
Serendipitously.
My God.
Not by design, but more happenstance. I was writing for a little website called Crime Library, which then Court TV bought out, and I ended up working for Court TV.
Uh-huh.
I decided to stop teaching philosophy and go to John Jay College of Criminal Justice for my master's in forensic psychology, just for fun and to do better with the writing I was doing, and that changed my life completely.
What is the fascination with crime, murders? I mean, the top-rated television shows, you know, are all crime shows and police shows.
Yeah, well,
what
part
is it?
Of that's because they're puzzles, and people love puzzles. They also love getting close to the excitement of danger and the creepiness of death and seeing, you know, guts spilled out or weird things that people do, like cannibalism or necrophilia. So there's an excitement factor to it, but coupled with the puzzle factor of not only who did this, but how did this person become this way? People are very, very caught up with what that's about, which is, you know, pretty much what Confession of a Serial Killer is all about, is step by step by step, here's how it happened.
Matt in Asheville, North Carolina, Wildcard Line. Hey, Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering if Dennis Rader ever had a medical diagnosis or a history of mental illness, and two, if the guest had ever done any research into the Zodiac Killer.
All right. Go ahead, Kat.
Well, Rader will say he has not researched the Zodiac because he was in the military overseas in Korea and Japan during the Zodiac time, And he said he kind of heard of him, but because he didn't have the same, the MO that interested him, which was binding and strangling and whatnot, that he really didn't pay any attention. I disagree with that. I think many of Rader's moves were very much like the Zodiac. I know that Rader tended to copy.
Writing the media and the police, perfect example.
Yeah, I mean, there were books and stuff when he got back. There were easily books to read about. The Zodiac is late 60s. He's back in the early 70s. I would think, and he's in Kansas as opposed to California. I'm pretty sure he's certainly copied the ruses and using the codes for the newspapers, and there's so much in common between the two of them that I think he probably did. But he really wasn't in the United States during, all the media frenzy of that particular set of crimes. He was overseas. So that's one answer. What was the other? Oh, does he have a medical diagnosis?
That you know of.
No mental illness ever been diagnosed in him, and basically all he's ever had is some basic physicals. He said he did once have an MRI, but he wasn't able to get a hold of that. I wished we could have gotten that, but if he had gone through a trial, he would have had all of those assessments done. But since he didn't, none of that was done, really. There was a little bit of stuff for competency, and nobody found him to be anything but basically narcissistic and some OCD.
Catherine, when you were talking with him, did you ever feel, even though it was via monitor, did you ever feel threatened, or did he try to intimidate you or anything like that?
No, he's always been very respectful of me. Really, the whole 5 years, 6 years we've known each other, he's always been very respectful.
Did he smile?
Yeah. We laugh. We talk about TV shows. We talk about the moon phases. We talk about all kinds of stuff.
My gosh. Okay, yeah. Good luck. Oh, one quick question. Where do we get the book?
Oh, the book can be gotten on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, in bookstores all over the place. It came out a couple weeks ago.
All right, great. Thanks, Catherine. We're going to come back in a moment with Michael Sala as we talk about the secret space program and why does physicist Stephen Hawking not want us to tell E.T. where we are.